This is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, NC Students Drowning in Student Debt. The average debt amount for college graduates in the state has risen anywhere from 50% to 300% in the past 16 years, depending on the four-year college they attended. And that's the headline on the front page. The actual article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline. Can we sustain this runaway student debt in North Carolina? And this article is written by Lauren Hong. Sarah Cowan of Raleigh, who works as a recruiter for a Texas company, went back to school for a bachelor's degree in 2005. Everybody I talked to was educated, and at that time people were pursuing their master's and PhD degrees, says the 35-year-old Cowan. I thought, wow, I'm not going to be able to get a job with just an associate's degree. If I ever was going to be able to compete in the Triangle, I needed to have some credentials. I needed something to make me stand apart. Cowan owed $53,000 after she graduated from NC State University and an online master's program at Villanova University. She has paid about $500 every month to reduce her student debt for the past 8 years. Now pregnant with her second child, she still owes $27,000. I just kind of assumed I was going to have to go into debt and pay for it for the rest of my adult life, she says. Cowan is one of the lucky ones who has managed to make a dent in her debt. A detailed analysis of student debt in North Carolina's four-year public and private universities shows student debt has risen anywhere from 50% to 300% at most colleges in the past 16 years. What's worse, the default rate in many cases has increased even faster, a trend that would negatively reverberate across the local, state, and regional economies in the form of lower housing demand, lower disposable income, and muted economic energy among millennials. For example, the median debt for students who completed a four-year degree program at UNC Chapel Hill was $15,906 in 2013, according to U.S. Department of Education data. In 1997, it was $10,159, a 56% increase in 16 years. At NCSU, the increase was about 42% during the same period. Duke, however, had a 57% decline in median student debt during the same period because of its hefty scholarship grant and foundation base. Meanwhile, smaller public and private schools, such as William Peace, 316% increase. Fayetteville State, 198% increase, Gardner-Webb, 99% increase, and UNC Asheville, 86% increase. Students are leaving with degrees in their hands and a hole in their wallets. It's a huge issue because it is so big. It's so hard to get rid of, says Timothy Ferguson of Chapel Hill, president of the Grotchy Institute, a policy institute. It's different because it is the first in a sequence. It is almost one of the first of a sequence of debt that you get. It is also different because higher education is semi-compulsory. A national problem. Student debt is the second largest category of debt in the United States, behind mortgages, according to the Federal Reserve. Soaring to $1.3 trillion and affecting 43.3 million people, it keeps growing. In fact, 70% of 2015 graduates are believed to have been in debt, owing an average of $31,051. And now the problem is seeping into other economic sectors. A joint survey conducted by SALT, a consumer literacy program, and the National Association of Realtors found that 71% of graduates are delaying home ownership due to their student debt. For the South Atlantic, 11% said they had difficulty making a down payment. Of this, 46% had student debt with the average amount of $15,000. They typically delayed buying a home by 3 years. The burdens also prevent graduates from saving for retirement. According to a Morningstar report, every additional dollar in student loan debt decreases retirement savings by 35 cents, meaning someone with $100,000 in student loan debt is set back $35,000 for retirement. The report says this holds true no matter how much one is earning. Just ask Sarah Nosov, 40, who attended UNC Medical School after a year of pre-medical studies in a private school in New York. With more than $100,000 in debt, Nosov was starting at that liability even after gaining in-state residency and getting a full tuition scholarship and a one-year paid research position. She has managed to whittle her debt down to about $30,000, but she has fallen behind many of her peers. "I'm 40, and I have no money in retirement," she says. "I'm just now starting to save." Risks of default. Jenna Robinson of the John William Pope Center for Higher Education in Raleigh says the students who are at the most risk of defaulting on loans are those who start school but don't finish. Default rates are directly related to whether students graduate. Duke, UNC, and NCSU have high graduation rates, students get good jobs, and can easily pay off debt, she says. HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities, often have lower graduation rates. Students who drop out have a harder time finding lucrative employment and thus can't pay off their debt. Researcher Nicole Smith of Research Triangle Park-based Science Consortium, RTI, says research suggests that students who go to graduate school are less likely to default on their loans. While these students have larger amounts of debt, they make progress on repaying that debt more quickly than their peers who did not complete, she says. Conversely, students who borrow the smallest amounts of money typically have the highest risk of default, as this includes dropouts who are only enrolled for one semester or two, says another RTI researcher, Jonathan Konzelman. Besides default rates, the Grachi Institute's Ferguson says he is the most shocked with the national data on graduation rates. He says the six-year graduation rate at four-year universities is less than 60%, and for private schools it is 65%. In North Carolina, 61.2% graduate in 6 years and 37.5% in 4 years. Citing figures from The Student Loan Mess by Joel and Eric Best, he says for-profit universities have one-eighth of the students who default, one-fourth of the debt, and half of the default rates. Debt now makes it that not finishing is worse than not starting, Ferguson says. If you're not going to graduate, it's better not to go at all from a financial standpoint. Duke has a six-year graduation rate of 94.2%, with UNC at 90% and NCSU at 74%. Addressing the problems. The average debt of North Carolina students who graduate from a public four-year university is $23,440, up 52% since 2007 to 2008, according to the Southern Regional Education Board. In July, North Carolina passed the Promise Tuition Bill, or Senate Bill 873, to slash tuition to $500 at Elizabeth City State University, UNC Pembroke, and Western Carolina University beginning in the fall of 2018. Another passed educational policy under review is the North Carolina Guaranteed Admission Program, which would direct students who are not academically prepared to community colleges. Students will be required to earn an associate's degree at a community college in exchange to have reserved seats at constituent colleges for deferred admission. It would decrease the number of students who rack up debt, then drop out, Robinson says. Community colleges are considerably more affordable than four-year institutions. The rising debt has implications down the line, says Ferguson. Economists and other publications can say they don't see a correlation, but I think common sense is going to tell you that the expenses are going up, wages are not going up, so of course it will impose a liquidity crunch and opportunity cost as well as a drag on the economy, he says. Some companies are beginning to offer tuition reimbursement programs and student loan debt repayment assistance. Cowan says her first employer, Arista Life Science, had a tuition reimbursement program. Through the IRS guideline that allows companies to offer tax-free incentives for employees on tuition reimbursement, employees can receive up to $5,250 per year per graduate. After meeting grade requirements and working with the company for a set number of years. She received about $5,000 in tuition reimbursement from her paycheck and non-tax reimbursement. Although there may be no single clear solution, there is a rising sense there is a dire need for answers. As for Cowan, she says she always expected to have to deal with debt. It is definitely a somber topic amongst people my age to sit around and talk about, the albatross of student debt, she says. Her goal is to pay off her debt by the time she is 40. That means she has 5 more years to pay off $27,000 in student debt to attain her goal. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Biz column, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. The first headline, now showing beer comfort food at NCSU. A local entrepreneur with deep ties to NC State University is betting on the future of Hillsborough Street, the central avenue across from campus that was once the epicenter of student life. Gary Bryant, who went to NCSU and was the basketball team manager when the Wolfpack won the 1983 NCAA title, opened the H Street Kitchen on August 3. Bryant and his partners gutted the old Varsity Theater to create a new restaurant with exposed wood and brick and an open kitchen. The theater had opened in 1941, but the area slumped as Raleigh surged in other directions. The site was a McDonald's and a bookstore before Bryant saw the possibilities for a restaurant. There's a lot of emotional connections with my going to NC State, says Bryant, whose father, Charlie, was the longtime executive director of the Wolfpack Club. When I was in school, there was a lot of energy and activity up and down this street. And it's been unfortunate that in the last 10 to 15 years, the street has not advanced at the same pace the city has advanced until 5 or 6 years ago when the university took a more active interest in bringing Hillsborough Street back and redeveloping properties up and down this street. Hillsborough Street had lagged Glenwood South and downtown and had been a bit of a dirty and overlooked part of the city. But Hillsborough Street, with its new landscaping and revised energy, is quickly perking up. H Street Kitchen will look to add to that as it opens in a unique space. What we uncovered was this beautiful architecture, he says. And this space is really unique because it was ground zero for NCSU for so many years. And in a section called On the Web, Raleigh's Wealthiest Streets. When Carolina Country Club began in 1910, the golf club was located about 2 miles outside the Raleigh city limits. Now the club and the prestigious neighborhoods that had helped spawn around it in Country Club Hills, Williamsboro, and Hayes Barton are among the most valuable residential real estate assets in the Triangle. Homes and lots with addresses along Holt Drive, Marlow Road, and Lakestone Drive are among the most coveted of Raleigh's oldest families and elite business leaders. Triangle Business Journal, with help from the Wake County Revenue Department, compiled this week a ranking of Raleigh's richest streets located inside the Beltline. For a list and rankings of these neighborhoods, go to the slideshow feature at trianglebusinessjournal.com. Banking on the value of solar, Logan Trading Company co-owner Joshua Logan loves talking about his newest project at the garden supply shop his family owns next to downtown Raleigh's Seaboard Station. The building is the former Seaboard train station building, and one of its defining features is a 1,500-foot-long canopy along the train track side of the building that has been mostly used for covered storage since the shop moved there in 1991. The canopy, he says, has turned out to be a perfect foundation for the shop's own solar panel array with space for about 306 panels capable of producing enough solar-generated electricity to power the whole building. I've been personally interested in renewable energy for about 5 years, says Logan, noting that he even invested in a small wind farm project a few years back that eventually folded. There's been a lot of new developments in solar in the last 10 years, and we felt it fit in well with our core values. Logan's will also be using the solar array's monitoring system inside the shop as a teaching tool for customers. Logan didn't want to say yet how much they are spending on the new solar panels, but he says they estimate they'll have a full return on the investment from the energy savings within the next 5 to 10 years. Olive oil craze coming to Durham in August. A new store in Durham will join the growing trend of stores that feature olive oil. Bull City Olive Oil will open in the Brightleaf District in late August and will focus on olive oil and vinegar. But owner Julie Steinhauer says the store also will carry a small and specific inventor to complement those offerings. For example, the store will have bread, cheese, and salami. Everything you need for a quick picnic or a special occasion evening, she said. The focus for me was to carry things you can't find in most places and to make entertaining easy. U.S. women's team has Tar Heel flavor. The Olympics are about to begin in Rio de Janeiro, and once again, the U.S. women's soccer team is packed with local connections. Five products of UNC Chapel Hill are on the women's active roster. Megan Klingenberg, Crystal Dunn, Tobin Heath, Whitney Engen, and Allie Long. Two others, Ashlyn Harris and Heather O'Reilly, will serve as alternates. And finally, in a section called By the Numbers, 1,000, number of UNC healthcare employees who could be moving to new office space that UNC is adding in Morrisville. 712, number of job cuts reported to the state of North Carolina in July, double the number for the same period in 2015. The seven-month layoff total for the state was 8,960. $17.75 million. Money a Florida developer is spending for the Village Plaza, a Chapel Hill shopping center. 16. Where Duke University Hospital ranks nationally, according to a U.S. News and World Report ranking. And 4.7%. Triangle unemployment in June, the lowest for a June since 2007. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Real Estate page written by Amanda Hoyle. The main headline, Highwoods plans to buy land for new office tower in downtown Raleigh. The owner and developer of the long-proposed 19-story Edison office tower in downtown Raleigh is in talks now to instead sell the high-profile corner site to the Triangle's largest office property owner, Highwoods Properties. Highwoods President and CEO Ed Frisch confirms that the Raleigh-based Real Estate Investment Trust has entered into a contract to buy the 0.7-acre site at the corner of Wilmington and Martin Streets from an affiliate of the real estate development and investment firm Beacon Partners. Frisch says that while the final land sale hasn't closed yet, the REIT, R-E-I-T, has already been working on several conceptual drawings for up to 300,000 square feet of office space, which would be larger and taller than Beacon's previous plans. An internal rendering of the new tower shows the building to be more than 21 stories tall. The new tower would be across the street from Raleigh's tallest building, the 33-story PNC Tower, which is also owned and managed by Highwoods Properties. Beacon and its local partner, developer Greg Sandruder, have been working on plans for the property since 2008, but have been unable to secure an anchor tenant or financing to break ground on the office project. It's something that we've been talking with Greg about for some time, Frisch says, and if we do, it needs to happen in the next month or so. If approved, the new Highwoods office tower site at Wilmington and Martin Streets would be the fourth new office building project announced in the downtown Raleigh district in the past year. American Girl to open holiday store at Crabtree Valley Mall. Popular doll retailer American Girl will be opening in time for the Christmas holiday shopping season. Temporary store locations at seven new Metro Mall locations across the country, including one coming to Crabtree Valley Mall in Raleigh. The new American Girl doll store in Raleigh will be opening for business on October 1 and will remain open through January 31. In a 5,500 square foot space near the Sears department store that was previously occupied by Rack Room Shoes. Dollar General buying 12 of 16 North Carolina Walmart Express stores. Discount retailer Dollar General Corporation has confirmed the purchase of 12 former Walmart Express store locations in Central North Carolina that were closed earlier this year as part of a cost-saving effort by Walmart Stores Incorporated. The North Carolina acquisitions were part of a portfolio of 41 former Walmart Express locations across 11 states purchased by Dollar General. Terms of the deal were not disclosed. The Tennessee-based company plans to relocate an existing store location into each of the purchase sites by October, according to a news release about the deal. The company did not detail its plans for the Dollar General store locations that would be closed. The new locations will also allow DG to expand its traditional product line to also include fresh meat and produce. And in a section called Stepping Down, national retailer Advance Auto Parts announced July 29 that the company's president, George Sherman, will step down from his current role in mid-August. Sherman, who has been with Advance Auto for 3 years, will remain with the company as a consultant through the end of 2016. Sherman's department follows the, or should say Sherman's departure follows the announcement in May that Chief Financial Officer Michael Nerona will also be resigning as soon as a successor for his position is found. And now we turn to the On Pharmaceuticals page written by Jason DeBruin. The main headline, finally, Transenteric shares good news with investors. Investors of Research Triangle Park-based medical device developer Transenteric heard some good news when the company announced it had made its first sale. In fact, investors liked it so much that they sent the stock up nearly 30% on that piece of news alone, bumping shares as high as $1.90 on August 2. After what had appeared to be a promising future in the field of developing robotics to improve minimally invasive surgery, Transenteric fell hard after the U.S. Food and Drug Administration dealt it a blow in denying its lead surgical robot under development. That ruling sent Transenteric shares from as high as $6 into penny stock range, and the company laid off 50 employees in the United States, or about 40% of its workforce in this country. That surgical robot under development was called Surgibot. During development, though, Transenteric had acquired the surgical robotics division of Sofar S.p.A., an Italian healthcare company. That deal brought a robotic system for minimally invasive surgery called Telelap Alf-X into Transenteric's arsenal. Transenteric CEO Todd Pope had initially intended the Alf-X and Surgibot to complement each other. However, the Alf-X can stand alone as it has already received European regulatory approval. After the FDA dealt its blow on Surgibot, Transenteric turned its focus to selling Alf-X in Europe and has now made its first sale to Humanitas Hospital in Milan, Italy. We are pleased to announce the first global sale of our Alf-X system, Pope said. Humanitas is an outstanding academic hospital with a respected multi-specialty surgical program. The Alf-X enables an enhanced surgical program through the use of advanced robotic technology with responsible procedural economics. To be sure, the completed sale comes later than Pope had hoped. On a conference call with analysts to discuss the FDA rejection and first quarter results, Pope said that he had given the sales team an aggressive goal to sell a system in the first quarter of 2016. This sale will be reflected in Transenteric's third quarter sales. And in a section called Rankings, U.S. News ranks Duke UNC Hospitals best in North Carolina. Triangle Area Hospitals again ranked competitively against peers across the state and nation, according to the latest U.S. News and World Report rankings. And we'll read just the top 10 of that list. Number 10, Rex Hospital. Tied at number 8, Novant Health Forsyth Medical Center and First Health Moore Regional Hospital. Number 7, Mission Hospital. Number 5, tied at 5, Vidant Medical Center and Moses H. Cone Memorial Hospital. Number 4, Carolinas Medical Center. Number 3, Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center. Number 2, University of North Carolina Hospitals. And number 1, Duke University Hospital. In a section called He Said It, the quote, I'm not leaving to play Pokemon Go full-time, so that's definitely not happening. That's from Jamie McDonald, Inc. Research CEO, on a conference call with analysts. McDonald announced he would resign from the company. In a section called Big Numbers, the big number is $645 million. Chapel Hill-based gene therapy startup Bamboo Therapeutics has been acquired by pharma giant Pfizer in a deal that could be worth up to $645 million. Bamboo shareholders received $150 million up front and could be in line for another $495 million, depending on milestones. Earlier this year, Pfizer had acquired 22% of Bamboo's fully diluted equity for $43 million. And finally, in a section called Postponed, Durham-based Bioventus postponed a $150 million initial public offering it had initially planned for this week. Citing market conditions, the company has not set a timeline for if it might complete an IPO, raise private funding, or simply wait for the market conditions to improve. The company had filed to offer 8.8 million shares at a range of between $16 and $18. Bioventus recorded $254 million in sales in 2015. And now we turn to the On Technology page, written by Lauren Onasorge. The first headline, In Motion Now beefs up capital with new round. Fresh off a $3.1 million funder in May, Morrisville-based In Motion Now has secured a $2 million debt facility, doubling down on its growth trajectory. CEO Ben Hardmere said in an interview that his company was able to leverage both its existing relationship with Bridge Bank and its recent fundraise for the loan. When you have institutional money behind the company, I think they look at it behind a different lens, he says, adding that the extra cash is all about flexibility. As we're continuing to grow the business, we want as much flexibility as possible so that when we want to make smart investments, we have the ability to do so. And those smart investments will likely be people, he says. The company, at 45 employees, has already released details of a bullish plan to be at more than 65 employees by the end of the year. In Motion Now has developed a creative production management solution that's all about simplifying how marketing and creative teams work on projects. Another victory for Cree over IP issues. Durham LED maker Cree scored another mini victory in its litigation war against a competitor. Cree received notice August 1 that the U.S. International Trade Commission found in its favor. In May, Cree had filed complaints with the ITC and the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Wisconsin against Feit Electric Company, spelled F-E-I-T, and its supplier, Unity Opto Technology Company, in order to curb what its attorneys saw as infringement on Cree patents. Not only did ITC find in Cree's favor this time around on four patent infringement violations, it also found that Feit Electric and Unity were misleading consumers by placing the Energy Star logo on products despite failing to meet the standards required for that mark. The ITC releases its final determination on the case by November 29. Brad Cohn, Cree's general counsel, released a statement saying the decision reaffirms Cree's innovative breakthroughs when it comes to efficient LED lighting products. We hope this decision results in an exclusion order and a cease and desist order that would protect both consumers and Cree by preventing the importation of products that improperly use Cree's patented technology, falsely claim to meet Energy Star requirements, or both, the statement continues. It's just the latest chapter in Cree's lengthy legal war against Feit Electric. Through back-and-forth litigation, Cree has made accusations about Feit Electric infringing on about 12 of its patents. NCSU beefs up team to forward circuits research. NC State University is teaming up with the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and Georgia Tech on what's being called the new Center for Advanced Electronics through Machine Learning. The center, funded for 5 years through the National Science Foundation's Industry University Cooperative Research Centers program, aims to speed up design and verification of microelectric circuits and systems, reducing both development costs and time to market when it comes to manufacturing integrated circuits, which are basically chips that power everything from smartwatches to supercomputers. According to NCSU's project site lead, Paul Franzen, those industrial partners include big brands such as IBM, Cisco, and HP. While the NSF is funding the overhead and management costs, it's the companies themselves that will be funding the innovation. And as university researchers help companies such as IBM with their design methods, the hope is a boost to the bottom line, which, according to Franzen, could be felt in the Greater Triangle economy. And the final article on this page, RDU flyers pay top dollar, but Charlotte is pricier. Flying out of Raleigh-Durham International Airport? Expect a discount compared to what waits in the Queen City. New numbers from the Department of Transportation's Bureau of Transportation Statistics show that when compared to other airports with originating passenger counts of between 500,000 and 999,999, RDU offered the ninth most expensive fare average in the quarter. Compare that to Charlotte Douglas International, which ranked second. And there's a listing of the top 10 airports with the highest first quarter average airfare. Topping the list, Washington Dulles, Virginia, $458. Charlotte, $450. Houston Bush, Texas, $444. Salt Lake City, Utah, $393. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, $388. Nashville, Tennessee, $379. Kansas City, Missouri, $375. Austin, Texas, $375. Raleigh-Durham, $374. And St. Louis, Missouri, $368. And now we turn to the A Better World page written by Todd Cohen. Todd Cohen also publishes Philanthropy North Carolina. And we'll start with his column. The headline, Senior Life Center Fulfills Noble Mission. Durham County is home to more than 49,000 individuals aged 65 and older, a population that is expected to grow to 69,000 in 2025. For many of those seniors, coping with daily life can be a challenge, and for their family members who typically serve as their volunteer caregivers, it can be physically and emotionally draining. Kathy Stallcup should know, for 4 years she lived in Taos, New Mexico, caring for her father, who had suffered a massive heart attack, and for her mother, who was in failing health. And for the past 2 years, as executive director of the Durham Center for Senior Life, she has headed an organization that provides programs and services for 5,000 to 6,000 seniors a year, as well as respite care for about 30 volunteer caregivers. I was totally privileged I could provide that for my parents, says Stallcup, who shopped and cooked for her parents, scheduled their doctor appointments, ran errands, and provided personal care and hygiene for them. Not every aging person has family members or devoted friends to provide that, she says. What happens to all these people? That's why we exist. Growing out of the Golden Age Society, a group founded in 1949 to provide neighborhood clubs for seniors, the center operates on an annual budget of $1.4 million, employs 16 people full-time and 8 part-time, and counts on 30 to 40 active volunteers. It operates a main facility downtown and 3 satellite sites. The satellites provide a daily meal to seniors and individuals with disabilities and opportunities to socialize. That's one of the devastating aspects of aging, Stallcup says. Some seniors cannot get out and about. We want to help seniors remain in their communities and take part in activities. The center provides transportation, an adult day health program, education, fitness, and exercise programs to promote health and prevent disease, activities from games to movies, and information and assistance to seniors facing challenges. And it provides respite and support for caregivers, contacting with in-home health vendors who can provide in-home aid so the caregivers can take a few hours off periodically. Caregivers typically are spouses, siblings, or other family members, many of them also seniors facing their own aging issues. The center, which is celebrating its 10th year in its current home downtown, will hold its annual fundraising breakfast on Thursday, October 13th at the center. Now, to find ways to expand its service to keep pace with the needs of the growing population of seniors, the center is about to begin working with Executive Service Corps of the Triangle to develop a strategic plan. The number we're serving now is a drop in the bucket, Stahlcup says. If we can provide them with a place where we can transport them and provide socialization activities for them, then we're hopefully alleviating some of the depression that can easily take place. And in nonprofit news, Duke Energy pours $40,000 into Girl Scouts. Girl Scouts North Carolina Coastal Pines received $40,000 from the Duke Energy Foundation to help support and expand TechnoQuest, an all-girl event focusing on science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM. TechnoQuest is a day-long event for over 150 middle and high school girls and provides opportunities to explore science and technology alongside professional women in STEM fields spanning from biology to computer programming to engineering. Summit Church hosts volunteer event. One of the Triangle's largest volunteer efforts kicks off on August 7. The collection of projects known as Serve RDU is a week of service set aside by Summit Church and will end with more than 10,000 volunteer hours. The largest project during the week will be a Triangle-wide drive to collect 3,000 backpacks filled with school supplies. Pyology Pizza raises cash for nonprofits. The new North Hills Pyology Pizzeria raised $6,200 for two local nonprofits. To celebrate the grand opening of the second Raleigh location, Pyology made the donations to the Boys and Girls Club and Carol's Kitchen. And now in general news in the Triangle Business Journal, we have an article written by Lauren Onasorge, the headline, Chinese firm picks Wayne County for expansion. Chinese sanitary products manufacturer Uplay Corporation has picked Eastern North Carolina over South Carolina for a new 88-job manufacturing facility, its first in the U.S. Uplay, a contract manufacturer that creates disposable sanitary products such as wet wipes and puppy training pads, will establish a manufacturing plant in Wayne County near the town of Mount Olive, investing nearly $21.3 million in the site over 4 years, Commerce officials said August 2nd. According to North Carolina Commerce Department spokesman David Rhodes, both North Carolina and South Carolina competed for the project, which is expected to bring an annual payroll boost of about $2.75 million to the local economy. In exchange for the investment, North Carolina approved Uplay for a performance-based grant of up to $200,000 from the One North Carolina Fund, which is contingent on a local match. The company was founded in 2006 in China and has about 310 employees. Commerce Secretary John Scavarla said August 2nd in a prepared statement that the site pick was further evidence that the world is bullish on North Carolina. Our state has ready infrastructure and excellent multimodal transportation, along with well-trained workers and a world-class business climate, he said. Wayne County, which has a median family income of about $51,000, has about a 5.2% unemployment rate. According to its Department of Commerce profile, the county has 93 manufacturing establishments. And we also have a question and answer session in this section. The headline, CBS's Nance, Charlotte's Quail Hollow should be a regular golf championship venue. And this was written by Eric Spanberg. On a hot Wednesday afternoon at the just-finished 2016 PGA Championship at Baltusrol Golf Club, the CBS production and broadcasting crew sought refuge in the sprawling compound of trucks and trailers located just beyond the course. The trailers offered two precious commodities, shade and air conditioning. Lance Barrow, the network's veteran coordinating producer for golf, closed an interview with me by instructing me not to let my next subject, Jim Nance, claim Charlotte as his hometown. As any golf fan who has watched the Wells Fargo Championship from Quail Hollow Club can tell you, Nance, the face and voice of CBS Sports, is a Charlotte native. He was born here, but grew up in New Jersey and went on to play golf at the University of Houston before becoming a sports broadcaster. His future Masters-winning teammate in college can't be mentioned in these kinds of stories any longer because its overuse and familiarity is the sports media equivalent of yelling Freebird or You to Man and believing yourself ironic and clever instead of cliched and more cliched. He still has family in the area, and his father is buried in Mount Holly. Next year, Nance, 57, will once again be part of CBS Sports' coverage of the PGA Championship, and it will be from a course he knows well, Quail Hollow, where Nance is a member. It will be the first major golf championship played in Charlotte. While prepping for the PGA Championship that ended July 31 in New Jersey, Nance gave a few thoughts on what he expects at Quail Hollow next summer, following our excerpts from that conversation. What do you think it will be like to have the PGA Championship at Quail Hollow? I've got a pretty good idea of what it's going to be. I've been there for all the Wells Fargo tournaments, which started in 2003. Nearly every time I've broadcast from there, I've attempted to wax poetic about how I see this as a major championship golf course, and now we're going to have a chance to do that. I don't have any doubt that Quail Hollow is going to absolutely be a huge smash success. It's going to be such a hit that they'll be angling, trying to figure out how to do more. This needs to be a regular major championship stage. I really believe that. The course is too strong. The hospitality of Charlotte is great. The organization, the infrastructure they have there, starting with club president Johnny Harris and Mac Everett, general chairman of the Wells Fargo Championship, they've got everything in place. They will be able to absorb all the extra focus, attention, media, fans. It's going to easily fit onto the Charlotte scene. You've done Super Bowls, you've done an Olympics, and I know Augusta and the Masters are special to you, but when you get to a major golf championship like this one, how is the week different for you? The fact that you have 98 of the top 100 players who are here at Baltusrol, the stakes are so vastly different. These are lifetime-making, career-making moments. That's where it starts. I call it golf immortality. It's a life-changing, career-defining event. I love regular tour golf. I'm around it all the time. You'd be surprised how little of it I go out and watch in person when I'm not on the air in the 18th tower. I'll have a computer screen in front of me and a TV next to that, and I'll basically just hit refresh and I'll see every score that gets registered to see what everybody in the field is doing, the best I can keep at it. How does your workload change for the PGA Championship? I'm only on for 2 hours on Thursday and Friday. It's good to just get in the game. I only do the cable on Thursdays and Fridays, on two occasions, Augusta and the PGA Championship. I take a shift at 5 o'clock on TNT's first and second round broadcasts. That usually means that I'll get to see all the marquee players finish their rounds, so I'll see Jordan Spieth, Rory McIlroy, Jason Day, Phil Mickelson, Dustin Johnson. I'll bring them all home. And now we'll turn to the Viewpoint page, and we'll read the Reporter's Notebook. And this is written by Riley McDermott, who works at the San Francisco Business Times, a TBJ sister publication. And the headline on this column, this Viewpoint column, is Here Comes 401k-Style Plans for Nation's Startups. A host of new startups are experimenting with robo-style investment services, launching online 401k plans for small business workers to satisfy both employee demand and state regulations, the Wall Street Journal reports. Some of the new companies include Dream Forward Financial LLC, Captain 401 Incorporated, For Us All Incorporated, and Save Day Incorporated, and are backed by venture capitalists and tech-savvy entrepreneurs looking to bring some retirement tools to the 42 million workers for businesses that employ 100 people or fewer. The 401k market is ripe for disruption. Cynthia Lowe, general manager of robo-advisory pioneer Betterment LLC's 401k business, told the paper, "Everybody is trying to leverage technology to make things more efficient." Some small businesses are enrolling because of state requirements that have recently begun to put pressure on them to provide some type of retirement options, including new laws in Connecticut, Maryland, Illinois, and Oregon. But there are still obstacles to tapping a previously uncharted part of the market, including walking businesses through the process and carving out market share. One is the difficulty of selling plans to mom-and-pop companies, a decentralized market in which many employers lack the time, expertise, and money to put plans in place, the journal reports. Another is rising competition from more established, low-cost players, including Employee Fiduciary LLC, a company that entered the small 401k market 12 years ago, and fund industry giant Vanguard Group Incorporated, which launched a small business 401k service in 2011. Still, better technology and the promise of lower fees may ultimately convince some small businesses, particularly tech startups with highly competitive workforce perks, to experiment with offering retirement plans even if they've never tried to in the past. The trend is very pro-consumer development, Mike Alfred, chief executive of BrightScope, told the paper. Alfred said that low-cost providers have helped push down fees paid by small business employees to 1.06% in 2013 from 1.21% in 2009 in plans with $1 million to $10 million in assets. Robos are driving fees down and making small plans better for the average person, he added. And now we turn to our People on the Move section, where the spotlight is on Kendra Martin, Executive Director of United Way of Lee County. In what she calls a natural fit, Kendra Martin has been named to the role of Executive Director of the United Way of Lee County. Martin joined the United Way staff about 2 years ago as a part-time coordinator with VolunteerLee.com, the United Way website that works to connect volunteers with local nonprofits. Last August, she was named Community Engagement Director, a position that continued her work with the website and added managing the annual fundraising campaign. Some of her community engagement duties will transition over into her new role as Executive Director. Martin has served as Interim Director of the United Way of Lee County since April 1. The interim tag was removed in late July. In this role, she works with the organization's board to help set its overall direction. She also oversees all operations, financial and administrative matters, annual campaign and community investment of the nonprofit. The United Way of Lee County has its home base in Sanford and is governed by a 15-member board of directors chaired by Michael Basinger. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? How wonderful it is to be able to give hope and help to people who are desperate, to help them not only with their immediate needs, but also to give them the tools and support they need to get on their feet again. What are some of your major goals for your new position? United Way of Lee County is doing great work in the areas of education, health, and financial stability. I want to make sure that everyone in the community knows about our work and how they can get involved. I'm especially interested in health-related initiatives and plan to explore some possibilities in that area. Biggest pet peeve? I have to admit that misspelled words bother me. Biggest worry? I know the stories of people in need in Lee County, and it worries me that children are going to bed hungry and that people can't afford needed medical care. Family, husband, Reverend Tim Martin, pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church in Sanford. Last book you've read, $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America, by Catherine Eden and H. Luke Schaefer. And now we'll turn to the small business section of the Triangle Business Journal and read the column written by Jim Verdonik, who is an attorney with Ward & Smith PA in Raleigh. And the headline on his column is, You Get What You Pay For in Tech Transfer. In the June 17th issue of Triangle Business Journal, the media organization published an article about technology transfer at our three biggest local universities that did a good job of telling us that universities in other states generate more license revenue and startups than our three local universities. However, the article left me wanting to know why and ways to improve. Naturally, the dollar amount of university research affects license revenue and the number of startups that universities generate. The type of research also matters. All quests for knowledge do not have equal economic value. But the problem is not exclusively with universities. What happens to technology after it leaves universities is the biggest factor in determining tech transfer's economic development contribution. Are local businesses sponsoring research at the same rate as Silicon Valley? Are local investors providing university startups sufficient capital? We may have a chicken and egg problem. Businesses claim universities are underperforming, while universities complain about the local business community. We all know businesses that produce great products but underperform because they don't invest enough in sales and marketing teams. That's the problem our local universities have. Let's focus on how funds are allocated within universities. What is the ratio of tech transfer spending to funding grants? You only get what you pay for, and tech transfer offices of local universities have been on starvation budgets for decades because they are usually at the end of a long line of university departments seeking money. That's not likely to change because tech transfer has no academic clout. One might be tempted to think that universities are driven by the quest for knowledge, but money determines power within universities like it does in other large organizations. If you have money in your budget to do projects, other people within the organization want to collaborate. Everyone wants to be your friend. Likewise, if you are always begging for money, others avoid you. This might not be the most positive side of human nature, but that is reality. Obviously, more money would give tech transfer offices the resources required to fund outreach to both the business community and the university research community. But how you get additional money to tech transfer offices matters, because money has a way of disappearing into the bottomless pits we call universities. I have a simple solution to local tech transfer money problems. Alumni and businesses should make donations to an independent foundation that targets funding tech transfer efforts at all the local universities. Then, instead of tech transfer being last in line for money, it will be first in line. To ensure the money does not disappear into the general university fund, the foundation should negotiate grant agreements with each school that exclusively fund additional tech transfer projects. Universities that fail to invest their own resources in tech transfer would receive less foundation grant money. Money is likely to flow to the schools that are most cooperative in ensuring that money is allocated only to tech transfer offices for projects the foundation approves. And with our remaining minutes with the Triangle Business Journal, we'll read as much as we can of the executive voice column that focuses on Richard Byrne. The headline, "He rinses, repeats the same formula. Byrne leads TowerCo exits with consistency." And this article is written by Lauren K. Onasorge. You could call Richard Byrne Mr. Exit. He'd tell you he's lucky. 4 years after orchestrating an asset sale worth nearly $1.5 billion, the CEO led TowerCo to another big-dollar deal. In May, the Kerry company announced it would be selling 252 towers and 95 other assets to Sarasota, Florida-based Grain Infrastructure, a deal worth $244 million. And it's the third tower portfolio the company has sold since 2004. It has become a pattern every 4 years. TowerCo, which counts among its equity investors, Tailwind Capital Partners, and Soros Fund Management, started yet another LLC in 2015. But the New Jersey native says he's not thinking about that four-year timeline. Byrne, who moved here when his then-employer Nextel sold a portfolio of towers to a firm in Cary, puts the bulk of the credit for his success on the team he's built over the past few years. What's the best piece of advice you were ever given, and who gave it to you? Right after we started TowerCo, I ran across this quote and stuck it to the frame of my computer monitor as a reminder that you need to be practical. It doesn't matter if you are right in the end, if you are out of business in the meantime. If you could pinpoint a defining circumstance that led you to the industry, what would it be? A friend of mine was an in-house recruiter for McCall Cellular in the New York metro market who called me one day and asked if I would consider coming to work for McCall. They were having trouble negotiating deals to place antennas on buildings and finding locations to build towers. I had spent most of my career in real estate managing property and was familiar with the other side of the transaction from the property owner perspective and thought it was great business. I took a cut in pay to get the job, and it has changed my life. What's been your biggest professional challenge, and how did you overcome it? I have had several major setbacks in my career, and I just had to adapt and keep grinding away. Success is a product of hard work and being in the right place at the right time. You might do all the right things, make all the right decisions, and yet be unlucky. Timing is an important part of the success equation. What's your biggest professional success? Gathering together a great group of people to work with every day. They make me look good. How would you describe your leadership style? I'm a stickler for everyone in the company having easy access to the information and tools they need to be successful in their job. Beyond that, I do my best to treat them fairly and try and stay out of their way. You've had a series of successful asset sales. How do you recognize that an offer is the right opportunity for you and your investors? I have learned the hard way to not get greedy. Early on in my career, I started a business with the idea of making a certain amount of money. I achieved that goal in a relatively short period of time and decided not to cash out. Not long after, the company took a major dive and I almost went bankrupt. Fortunately, I was able to work through it and avoid bankruptcy, but it was a very difficult 5 years. After that, whenever I started something, I decided up front what I wanted to make, and when I hit that number, I cashed out. If you weren't CEO of TowerCo, what would you be doing? I'm not sure, but I have always liked the excitement and mental challenges that come with startup opportunities, so probably something along that line. What's your go-to vacation spot? After the sale of the first TowerCo, Sandy and I purchased a house at Wrightsville Beach. It's a great place for us to go and relax. What makes TowerCo unique? The people. The vast majority of this team has been together since early in TowerCo. I and a handful of us go back one or two jobs before TowerCo. It's a great group of people who know what they're doing, they work hard, and they get along with each other. What's something most people don't know about you? It took me 26 years to get my college degree. I never really enjoyed school, and I always loved to work, so every time I had to choose between the two, I picked work. I always promised my mom I would get my degree, and I did. Unfortunately, she wasn't alive to see it happen. What did you want to be when you grew up? I don't recall. Probably a fireman or a professional baseball player. And we're going to stop right there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.